This is Anne DeVore, 20 April 2001. The Power of Naming, Individuation in Egyptian and Archaic Greek Texts. Tape 1 of 1.
She graduated from the University of Boulder, Colorado, and she has a PhD in developmental psychology. She's also a graduate of the Interregional Analytic Institute. She is one of the early comers to the Seattle area among the analytic community. And she's been a guest speaker for Jung Society several times over the past, how many years, Anne? 22 years.
Probably one of the first when we founded the society in 1979, I was one of the first.
So, and you're still with us, great. Anne has many interests in addition to her interest in Yeats, which she talks about in the newsletter. She's interested in astrology, creativity, and the classics and literature. I have always known Anne to be very thorough in her research and in her knowledge of the subject on which she selects to speak, and I always learn something from the hard work she does. As a true Sagittarius, she is able to bring a spark to whatever she does. So please welcome Anne DeVore.
That's my right field. Let's see. If we put it on the body, it's going to do that. Maybe it's okay. Is it going to work?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I can hear the ring in my ear, but might just have to tone it down a little bit. This is a topic that kind of rests in several areas of my own analysis, my educational background, and my thinking through some of the techniques that my own analysts taught me that seem productive in helping people further their own analytical work. My analysts, with the exception of John Perry, were all sensate types. And it wasn't that I intended that, it's that I was attracted to my true opposites. And I ended up working with David Hart and Jane Wheelwright. I also had the privilege of working with my thinking opposites, John Perry and Linda Leonard. And being an introverted feeler, they had to find a way to bridge the gap between all the words that a thinker would use and all of the dreaming that a thinker might generate and the rather few words that a feeler generates and the paucity of imagery that a feeler generates. My most and best fit were Jane and David, because they could meet me in music. They both were musicians, and we could start with a nonverbal place. We could start with an image. And all of us were poets of sorts. Linda Leonard was a great poet, and John Perry was interested in mythology. So from the context of poetry and from the context of my few words and my few and far between, but rather interesting dreams, we developed what we called the process of naming. There was another person I worked with, Harry Wilmer, who worked with people who were in locked wards in San Antonio Veterans Administration Hospital. And his approach was to have people who were in a psychotic state be in group together explaining their artwork. And they could not get off the locked ward until they could explain to other psychotic people what their process was. And in the process of explaining imagery and storyline, they developed clarity. And his process was one that I really loved, because what he taught them to do was to paint a dream and then put a title on it. The power of the naming of the craziness, if you will. So all of these techniques, whether we think of it as image and title or naming of a complex or the naming of a subpersonality, My other training was in Gestalt and Marino-style psychodrama, and, of course, playing and acting and naming and writing scripts. This helped me to become a much more verbal person. But I always, to this day, have to go back to that naming process when I'm in a quandary about a next step or whatever complex has seized me. I became interested in the history of naming because about 1994, as a result of my interest in Yeats, I decided that to be true to Yeats, I needed to learn some Latin and Greek. So I went back to the university and I enrolled as a beginning student in Latin and Greek, only to become immersed in these old texts that had lists of names and places and ships and wonderful gods and goddesses. I went on to take some hieroglyphics. We have a teacher at the U now who teaches hieroglyphics. And again, the naming of all the pharaohs, the importance of the lists of their history, I got interested in what the key question was that both Egypt and the Greek writers of the Archaic period were struggling with. The astrological writer, Dane Rudger, summarizes it in his own words by saying, "Who are we? Why were we born? What, if anything, transcends death? And who are those greater than we?" So these are the questions that I think infuse Egyptian and Greek writing, and certainly are the questions that I think analysis leads us to. Jung would call that individuation, because what you have to do is name who you really are and explain that to another person. And David's approach to analysis was to simply listen and ask questions. And he felt that we could leave analysis when we could admit who we are and also explain that simple truth to one other person. I find that a very powerful thing, because when I start working with people, I often find that they're scattered all over the map. But as Jung would say, the people begin to dream for the analyst, and so because they're dreaming for an introverted feeling type, the dreams begin to center around a topic, which we then name. We work on that, and then they spread out again, and then they center around a topic. And it's really, I think, a very powerful image to work with when you look at the footsteps along the way are really named as a map. And so we're moving, as the Greeks do, from island to island or from world to world. And you can do that as long as you know the name of the place. That's the topic of the Odyssey, and we're not talking about the Odyssey, but we're tonight talking about a conflict that arises when we do not know who we serve. And I'm going to contrast the Greeks and the Egyptians. The Egyptians knew very well who they served, and they knew very well who the king was and what the king represented. By the time we move into archaic Greek literature, there is a conflict in the Iliad which tells us that they no longer serve the gods in the old way. They really don't no longer want to serve the king in the old way. And in the kind of graphic naming and the types of death that Homer portrays, we will see that each individual is now as important as the High King. And they are longing for a different kind of home for their own spirit. The other thing that is related is a word that we have to consider when we look at particularly Egypt, and that is the word magic. And if you contrast two cultures, if I had to say what Egypt is and what Greek mythology is, one is a magical system and one is a religious system. You find a distinction because when we use magic, we are naming a goal and then finding a way to reach that goal as individuals. And because Egypt was, we could say, a theocracy where everyone participated through ritual and through prescribed prayer, each person had some power over the kind of petitions that they made for their children and for their life. When we move into Greek society, we find a vast separation between man and God, and it's through rituals like sacrifice and through prayer and through priests that we find that the Greeks are attempting to bridge that gap. So you have to keep in mind that I can't give you a history without having you understand that we're really dealing with two distinct cultures and two very different approaches. The concept of magic for us is foreign to the Greeks as it is to us. The Greeks really thought that the Magi came from the East or from Egypt, maybe Persia, but the Egyptians were magic. And what magic really is inseparable from, if you move in a realm of sound, is that the statue of Isis is also a sound, a phoneme, and is also a word of power. So when you travel into old areas in Egypt and you see statues on each side of the gates, what people did when they walked through is to say the names and invoke, in fact, the power of the gods and goddesses as they moved into the temple that is devoted to them. So every act of Egyptian society was based on naming and saying it correctly and then invoking and becoming part of that Egyptian god's chamber. Magic in religion is a different concept. We could say prayer is a form of magic, but in fact it really is a petition, a petio, it's asking, it's a begging almost, whereas an invocation of the god and a becoming of the god is at root of most Egyptian ritual. One of the things that we have to understand in Egypt is that even medical treatment is a form of magic. So the naming of the parts of the body, and they were very good at anatomy. They understood as many as 300 different operations by the time, surgical procedures. By the time we get into the medieval period, we've been reduced to fewer than 30 surgical procedures. In Greece, surgical procedures were forbidden by the Hippocratic Society. They did not do surgery. You had to go to a person who could either take the gallstone out, but they were not allowed as doctors to enter the body. So the Greeks were relatively ignorant of the physical anatomy. The Greeks knew more about the psychological state. In Egypt, we don't have a lot of insight, you could say, into the psychological state. They believed in many bodies, and they almost are the foundation for what we call theosophy in our Victorian period, when Madame Blavatsky and the Victorians resurrected the soul body and all of that. They took that directly from Egypt. So we're really talking about a group of people who both knew anatomy and also had an anatomy of the soul body, and a group of people who really were talking about physical bodies as energy and a carrier of a personality. And they mostly talked about the thumos. The Greeks believed that everything was carried in the heart. So they're really talking about psychological processes. And I'm just trying to give you an idea of what the differences are at this moment. In Egypt, and I'll concentrate now mainly on Egypt, the name that you have, which is given to you by one of your parents, is secret. You are told that name if you are, at puberty, deemed worthy of that name. So there is a concept that we could call the ka, which is the soul, that comes and incarnates out of love of the earth and out of love of Egypt. Their creation myth and their incarnation myth has to do with a great sense of love. They believe that we come in because the soul looks down and it's so beautiful and you're attracted into a body. Then you're here and you have to do good work, and that's defined by serving the state and serving the king and serving the gods. But there is a place that we'll come to where when you die, to get back to the heaven world, you have to have received this, it's like the rite of entry, and the rite of entry has to do with 41 things that you have not done. So the whole concept of ethics and goodness permeates the whole society from the very beginning. The Egyptian word Rin just means the name. It's as immortal as the ka. So when you die, your name and your ka return to the heaven world. Now, you want it to be a good name. So there are other qualities, the Rin A'a, which is called the great name. If you're not so great, it's the Rin Nejis, which is the little name, or the Rin Nefer, which is a beautiful name. But the secret name is the Rin Ma'a, the true name. That also can be known as the Rin Shepa, which is a star name. Seshet is a messenger. She wears a goddess star on her head. And so Mat and Seshet are the two gods and goddesses that are involved. The name is given to the child by the mother. It was only revealed to the child when you become an adult, which for women is puberty, and for men is when you're ready to enter into your profession. And it's only if you're judged worthy. There's no worse punishment in Egypt than to be deprived of one's name. And that is called the Dem Ren. So if a judge calls you Dem Ren, you are stripped of your name for all eternity, and you are no person, you are no one in Egyptian society from that time on. They give you a criminal's name, basically, and you have no rights. And that would be worse. That would be a far worse than death to an Egyptian, to have been deprived of the name. And Dem means knife, and it simply means we cut you. They did not do capital punishment. They just cut you. When we get into the Greek society, the worst thing that can happen is to be without a home. And that is exile. So if you try to assassinate someone in Egypt, you get Demrin. And if you're a killer in Egypt, you're an outcast. You have to leave home and you can never come to Greece again. So they came up with the most shaming things. These would be the most shaming things. Then there's a couple of interesting things that we can look at. There's a couple of names that are unchanged from Egyptian times, and one of them is Susan, and it means she of the lotus. And another one is Isadora, and it has to do with Isis Dora. Isis gave a gift, so the one that Isis gave. A name for a man is Unnefer, Humphrey, and it has to do with the perfect man. So these are names that are that come to us that we can still find pretty much unchanged. I'm going to tell you a little story about Tutankhamun. And one of the things we didn't know is that he existed. And for an Egyptian, a king or anyone, to be forgotten is as bad as to be Demrin, to be cut off. So Tutankhamun was not on the list of kings, and Carter, who did the excavation, knew by excavating in the Valley of the Kings that there was a tomb that was in the place between two other kings, but there was no name and there was no marking stone. But because of this, it was also a tomb that, when it was finally opened, had not been robbed, because no one knew it was there, because it had been execrated. So when we found Tutankhamun's place of burial and all those gorgeous, beautiful gold objects that actually I saw the first year I was in Seattle at the Seattle Center, that was one of the first complete tombs that had beautiful objects that we could begin to look at all of the funerary wear, we call it, and what a king needed to go to the other world. What that also did is bring him back to life, because what happens in these old Egyptian rituals, particularly the Book of the Dead, is there's a spell that is to help your relatives say your name forever, so that you live forever in the naming, the lineage. It's why the king's lists were made. It's why we know all of the names, including the servants of every household in a lot of the towns of common people, because it's important that the name be spoken so that you are not forgotten. So when we found the name of Tutankhamun, in fact, we revived him. We restored him to eternal life because your name is equivalent to your soul, is equivalent to the essence that lived on this earth. So it's not just an identifying label. It's actually a part of your being. As such, it's much more important than names in the modern world. Although I have to say my father, for some reason, took naming very seriously, and he spent a lot of time coming up with the perfect name for me, which I had to grow into because I was anything but peace and grace. He named me Ann Irene, which was peace and grace. And I was an awkward, clumsy child, and I was anything but peaceful. And I've had to live up to this one. But he took naming very seriously, and there are cultures that still take naming very seriously. All you have to do is say the name, and you invoke that person, and you invoke the God that is associated with that person. If you can say the name, you have power over that person. So one of the things that you never give, other than the mother to the child, is a secret name, and the child and the mother are the only ones who share that knowledge. There's a little story about Isis that demonstrates how much she loved Horus, her son, and when Horus was born, she wanted to not only give him a powerful name, but she wanted to give him all the power of the universe. And so what she did is devise a little snake, which she named, and put it in the path of Ra, and when he took his daily walk, it bit him. And because he had not created it, he did not know its name, and so he could not give himself the antidote to the poison. So he goes to Isis, because he thought, this is a cunning thing, it had to be Isis's trick, and he begs her, because he's declining fast, to heal him, because she was a goddess of magic and healing. And she said, no. She says, yeah, I have the antidote, but I need your secret name. You give me the secret name of Ra, and I will heal you. And Ra wouldn't do it. And finally, he's near death on his dying last gasp, because you see, for Egypt, even the gods had some mortality. They actually could be destroyed. And in his last gasp, he tells her the secret name. And so she gives him the antidote, and he comes back to life. And then he says, but promise me you won't give the name to Horus. And she says, I will promise you that he won't give the name to anyone else. So Horus had the power to find all of the parts of Osiris, and they could put Osiris back together, which, you know, you have to know that Egypt and Greece have their share of pornography, because Horus was formed out of the phallus of Osiris, and so they had to find the rest of the body to get all the parts back together. But knowing the name of Ra, they were able to put him back together, and then he became the king of the dead. He became like Osiris is both the king of the living and the dead. So we now know the name of Osiris, and so when Egyptians are dying, they go through rituals to become Osiris, and then at some point when they go into the underworld, then Osiris helps them to go through the rituals to become on the bark like Ra. So they become like Ra as they move back into the light. Now, Ra had many names we know. Ra's Egyptian name as the solar deity, when he's Ra in the middle of the day or at noon, his name is Ra, which is the face of the sun. When he's at the sunset, he's Atum. And rising, he is Kefri. And Kefri simply is a verb that has to do with the rising sun. So he is Kefri in the morning. He is Ra Akati or Atum in the evening, and he's Ra in the middle of the day. He himself has a hidden name, which we know, but it is in all the texts made clear to us it's not the secret name. It is only a hidden name. Now, part of my interest in Yeats is that he is interested in eclipses, and part of the power of Ra is that he is the undying god, and they know this because it is still, the corona of the sun is still alive at the moment of totality. So Ra is hidden, but still living, and you can witness his spirit in the beauty of the eclipse. So the Egyptians actually gave us a lot of the astronomical texts to do with the rising and the setting of the sun and the motion of the moon and the eclipses, and they actually knew about what the astronomers called the Saros cycle, which meant that they had to be making observations for several thousand years, because the Saros cycle is about 1,700 years. So they knew how to predict eclipses. Why? Because they wanted to see Ra in his most beautiful state. One of the names of one of the teachers, Amenemhat, is the Amen is the hidden god in the most hidden part of the temple. So Amenemhat is a very powerful teacher, and he gave the 30 books to young people in Egypt, in which he names all of the virtues that you have to achieve in order to be a good citizen. Some of the wonderful names, when you go to the other world, you have to pass a test called True of Voice, and that has to do with naming all of the 42 gods that sit in judgment with Mot. And each of them, you also have to make a negative confession. And so I just gathered a few of these. They have great names. Hail, Strider, coming forth from Heliophysis. I have done no wrong. Hail, Eater of Shadows, coming forth from the caverns. I have not slain men. And you have to say that one twice. Hail, He whose two eyes are on fire, coming forth from Sais. I have not defiled anything to do with the temple or the gods. Hail, Breaker of Bones, coming forth from darkness. I have not transgressed. Hail, Eater of Intestines, coming forth from the 33. I have not desolated the plowed fields. Hail, Doubly Wicked, coming forth from Ati. I have not defiled the wife of another man. Hail, Disposer of Speech, coming from the Werut. I have not inflamed myself with rage. Hail, Provider for Mankind, coming forth from Sais. I do not curse my God. Hail, White Teeth, coming forth from Tashi. I have not slaughtered the divine cattle. After all of these denials of wrongdoing, then you have a right to go into the inner hall. But before you do that, you have to name all the 42 parts of the door, the bolt, the handle, the lintel. And after you've done that, and all the parts of the doors request their name, you are allowed to enter the inner sanctum. And after that, then, even the floor of the sacred temple requests its name. And when you finally have passed that test, then you are in the aditum, or the inner sanctum, the opet. So everything is written on the funerary text. We call that the Book of the Dead. And it's rolled up and it's placed between your thighs. It's almost like a phallus, because it's a symbol of power. And kings had it, courtiers had it, all the way down until we get to the Middle Kingdom, and then even common people had it. And finally, when we get to the New Kingdom, everybody wanted it, and so it was inscribed basically in short form on the lid of the coffin, so that you could lie in the coffin and read all these. This is basically a crib sheet for getting into heaven. And it's pretty cool. I liked it. I saw one, they had one in Portland. I was thinking they had one here, but the one in Portland was quite impressive a couple of years ago when I went down. It was very long and written in Herodic, and I couldn't read it. I could read only the god names, but it was interesting. So a king, when he became the Pharaoh, became God. So we have a concept in, this is a big difference between Egypt and Greece. You have a theocracy, and that's what theocracy means, is that the living leader is a god. In Greece, remember that we have not only not a unified country, each of the major parts of Greece were city-states, but they made so certain that no despot or one dictator could take over that they did not even allow people to rule for more than one out of 33 days. So they had an elaborate system of rotation, and everything was done by lot. And in Egypt, you have kings that, if they were able, could rule, some of them, 60, 70 years. I mean, they were very long-lived. They had good food. They had all the privileges of a well-fed and cared for. They were pretty careful to keep war out of their country. They fought other places. They went to Nubia. They went to Ethiopia. They went to Israel. They went up into Anatolia. But they kept the fighting as much as possible, except when two kings were vying for power out of Egypt. So you have a long-lived, healthy population that basically were gods. These were long-lived kings. They took on the Day of Ascension, and that's what they called it when they became Pharaoh. They ascended to a place that we would consider archetypal as opposed to personal. They became a king who had five god names. The secret name that their mother gave them as a little child was never revealed. And that was the one power that they retained as a person, is the secret name that their mother had given them. But we know all five names of most of the pharaohs. The Horus name is indicative of that the king becomes like Horus. And it's written they call it on a stele. It's a little podium with the falcon sitting on top and then the Horus name. And it is associated also with the soul of the king, because the king is no longer a personal soul. He's now the soul of Horus. His Nepti name, means two ladies. And as king, as pharaoh, he has united Upper and Lower Egypt. And so you have Nekbet, the vulture goddess of Upper Egypt, and Edjo, the cobra goddess of Lower Egypt. And so on the little pharaoh hat, you see the vulture and the cobra. If you look closely, some people think that's two cobras, but it's actually a vulture and a cobra. And they have a Nepti name that goes with that. And it's part of who protects the king. Those are protective goddesses. Then there's a golden Horus name. So all the kings represent the Nabu, the gold. And they are like Horus, except that they are gold in their spirit. Then there's a prename and a nomen. The prenomen and the nomen are the ones we see in the cartouches. And these are chosen by the king partly on the basis of the family and partly on the basis of the attributes that they want to have as the son of Ra. So the prenome we call the Nezubi name. It's the sedge, and the one who belongs to the sedge and the bee. The sedge is a plant and the little bee wing. So this means this is a king who's united Upper and Lower Egypt. And then the nomen, which is never translated into English. So all of these other names are translated into English, but you would not translate Tutmosis or Amenhotep or Tutankhamun, because it would be Sa-Ra Tutankhamun, son of Ra Tutankhamun, even though Tutankhamun means the picture of the living Amun, the picture of the living hidden god. You wouldn't say that in English, though. You have to honor his real name. We know from legal documents that there are deeds that transferred property from one person to another, and that went down it could go down either the matrilineal or the patrilineal line, depending on which parent survived. And part of what we know is that there were official lists of every individual in every household, and that included the names of the family members and all of their serfs. We would call them servants, slaves. It is interesting to observe the names of the female slaves are included, but the names of the male slaves are included under their job site. So if they were the builder of a great pyramid, all of those men are listed as part of that workforce. And the thing that I want to make clear about Egypt is that slaves could own property. Usually a person, we would consider a slave someone who had no rights, but they had rights to property. They usually became slaves because they were part of war booty. They perhaps were taken on a foreign battle. And one of the things we know about scribes is that the Egyptians so revered educated people. They often stole people from Greece or from other countries who could read and write because they wanted, particularly in the New Kingdom, to have their children multilingual. So you find a lot of Greek-sounding names on these lists that are, they were stolen, and they are in slavery because you can't leave. They're so valuable. We also know that the eldest son of every family is the one who is called he who causes names to live, and he is the personal priest for the family, and he is the one who has to do the remembrances each year on the day of the death of the person who passed on. So a prudent man also can provide for survival if he can afford it by having a priest do that, but it's generally considered more powerful if a family member does that for you. Another thing that we want to remind people about Egypt is that because the name is your essence, you're very vulnerable in many ways other than having family members die and no longer remember you. Literally, what happens is that enemies can chip your name off your wall of your tomb. They can destroy your stele. They can break your statue. They can also deface, as they did with Tutankhamun's family, because Aten was a god that was replacing Amun and Ra. They chipped that whole family's name off of their gravesites, and they also chipped the name of Aten off of the wall. So we didn't know about these things until we were able to reconstruct Tutankhamun's lineage and look at his history, which was written, and know that he had been given one name and then took another name in order to not be assassinated. He died young. We don't know if he died because he had a form of Morfans disease or whether he was assassinated. But in any case, it's through his tomb that we know that kings can be wiped out by simply chipping their name off the wall. We also have in Egyptian texts, what we call execration texts. These are short magical texts that vilify foreigners or individuals who you don't like or even diseases that you don't want to plague your family. You put it on a piece of clay as a tablet. You then crush this thing and bury it so that it is stamped out. Very important little piece of magic we should all practice. And the other thing is you want to preserve your name in some cartouche form, and you probably want to have that. I mean, it's probably why we have those, what do they call them, the boxes at the bank, the safe deposit boxes. You want to have that a copy of that somewhere, and that's kind of what these stamps were, so that if other names are destroyed, and you always have a place of hiding for a little piece of the cartouche or something written on a scarab. And the other thing to remember is that they were great portraiture sculptors, and they liked to make portraits of each other in clay. And what you didn't want is for someone to smash that, because if it had your name on it, it was considered your true likeness, and naming makes it real, and so you don't want your statue defaced. And you do see some of those. We just see that, and the Taliban just did that to Buddha, actually. They destroyed him. Okay. I could give you a short break now, and we could do Greece, because Greece is more intense. So I'm going to switch gears and move into a more personable, person-related, individuated, you could say, culture, where individuals count, where each individual is particularly remembered by the nature of one's death. You have to think of Greece as, I think of They're very, very emotional in the time of Homer. They are, nevertheless, we're dealing with the cult of the hero. I think you have to erase everything that our modern stereotype attaches to the word hero. These are not living beings. You see, to be a hero, you must enter the Heroon, which is your grave. So a hero and the cult of the hero has to do with, it's very similar really to our concept of deeds done in the name of saints in the Catholic Church. The cult of the hero has to do with the cult of Heracles, the cult of Achilles. All of these are great warriors who died, and then miracles, we could call it, or good deeds are done in the name of that hero. And they have cult statues, they have words of power. You pray to the hero to intervene in the face of an angry god. But our concept of modern hero, where, you know, they say to somebody who landed the airplane, you're a hero. Well, he survived it, so he is a person who did a great feat, but he's not yet a hero. And that's, I think, important, because we're going to where we are dealing with the fall, you could say, of kingship and the fall of the power that a king has over his vassals. It's an aristocracy. It is very similar to medieval aristocracies with kings and serfs and servants and knights. The words are even very similar in the Iliad. But you're going to hear what I consider an anti-war, anti-aristocracy, anti-king theme carried in the character of Achilles. The poet also, from time to time, inserts his opinion. And I actually, I've read the Iliad several times in the last few years, and I am more and more convinced that it really is a plea to turn away from this kind of senseless violence and to move into home and hearth. By the time we get into the 5th century, we are dealing with a democracy where we have no desire at all for any one person to have any amount of power. So everything is done by lot. It's a very cumbersome system. Juries are 500 people who each have one vote. You must serve in the democracy. Every man who is a free man has to serve in the democracy on a rotating basis, because they are so unwilling to have any risk of these kings coming back into power. This is so opposite of Egypt, where we saw how everything really is a part and parcel of not only honoring the king who is the god, but becoming the king and transcending that king to become a god yourself. You have to also look at the 5th century heresy. You could be executed in Greece. This is one of the few capital punishments for hubris, which literally had to do with assuming, in the way of a sophist, that you were a god. So on the temple of Apollo, who is a very dark character, there is a warning: man, know thyself. And what that really means is know your place. You're a human. You are not a god. If you come in here, you are treading on my territory. So this is so different from Egypt, where you walk between the great gates and you say the names of the gods and you go into the inner sanctum. You put your gifts on the altar. You partake in a great feast. The altar is outside in Greece. It's on a big promontory or a rock, if there were one. They burned sacrifices. It's debatable if you look at one of the darker plays in Greek history, Iphigenia, whether they did human sacrifice. But I think, essentially, I'm convinced that if that were part of the Iliad, it was a part of the reason that the Trojan War was such a tragedy, is that it started with a tragedy perpetrated by a family that already was involved in tragedy. the House of Atreus. So I'm going to go through some texts, and I'm sorry I have to read them, I hope that I hope my reading won't just slaughter this, but it will give you a sense of the Iliad, and it will give you a sense of the conflict in the Iliad about individuals versus serving the king. One way that you became eternal, the only way really, was through lineage in Greece. The second way is through being part of a great song. And so the poets and the lyric poets of the archaic period, particularly Homer, and when you think of Archilochus or Sappho, Solon, what the epic poets were talking about is the gods and the history. What the lyric poets were doing is the very same thing that Yeats was doing, where he writes a poem to a pilot who has fallen. It's about love, it's about war, it's about family. And lyric poetry is a commemoration of a race that is won. You get that sense in Yeats. So Easter Sunday is a very dark poem about a great battle in Ireland on an Easter Sunday where many people fell in, I guess, 1912, maybe 1919. But in any case, that's what lyric poetry is about. It's about life. These are songs of life. The epic poem is also, it's just a very long poem about life, and it's also about death, because a hero earns his right to eternity by having a good death. And we will see in the character of Hector the only instance, really, of a person in the Iliad pleading for life so that he can go home to his family. So he did not have a good death. He did not earn his heroship. We hear about the song aspect in the voice of Helen, who in book 6 of the Iliad is saying, "Hector, come now and rest on this chair, since it is on your heart beyond all that the hard work has fallen for the sake of dishonored me and the blind act of Alexandros. Us two, on whom Zeus has set a vile destiny, so that hereafter we shall be made into things of song for the men of the future." She is also shown throughout the Iliad weaving a great red robe. It's the color of blood, and it weaves the stories as each warrior falls. So it's through tapestry and through song that you win through to eternity. One of the tragedies of being killed in action in Troy for the Greeks is that they had to burn the corpses, and so they didn't have the burial mounds. They couldn't take the bodies home to Greece. They couldn't. They had to make sure that they remembered who was fallen, and so you probably get that sense of around the fireside at night, the poets and the bards singing about the deaths that had happened to give the fallen hero some honor. So that's how I see what the Iliad is about. It is a great, endless song about life in this time. Another thing we find in Greek poetry is the naming through simile. The attempt to come so close to the essence of what a thing is. They're very attentive to language. They're very attentive to the sounds and the rhythms, which is why Yeats was attracted to the Iliad and to the tragedies. And I'll read you the opening of, if this is in English, I wouldn't trust my Greek, but in this, we hear the title of, or the purpose of the whole poem, and it's about anger. And we hear its many forms. Sing, goddess, the anger of Peleus' son Achilles and its devastation, which put pains thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades, strong souls of heroes, but gave their bodies to the delicate feasting of dogs. And the will of Zeus was accomplished since that time, when first there stood in division of conflict Atreus' son, the lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. Anger, devastation, feast for the dogs, conflict. That's what this poem is about. But what was the god that set them together in bitter collision? Zeus, son of Leto's Apollo, who in anger at the king drove the foul pestilence along the host, and the people perished, since Atreus' son had dishonored Chryses, priest of Apollo, when he came beside the fast ships of the Achaeans to ransom back his daughter. He came bearing gifts and holding in his hands, wound on a staff of gold, the ribbons of Apollo, who strikes from afar. And he supplicated all the Achaeans, but above all Atreus' two sons, the marshals of the people. Sons of Atreus, give me back my own daughter and take the ransom, giving honor to Zeus' son who strikes from afar, Apollo. But this pleased not the heart of Agamemnon, who harshly drove him away and said, never let me find you again, old sir, near our hollow ships. That girl I will not give back. Sooner will old age come upon her in my own house in Argos, far from her own land, going up and down by the loom and being in my bed. So go now. Do not make me angry. So this sad old priest goes in solitude and prays to King Apollo, whom Leto of the lovely hair bore. Hear me, Lord of Silver Bow, who set your power about Chryse and Cilla, the sacrosanct. If ever your heart was pleased that I built your temple, if ever it pleased you that I burned all those rich thigh pieces of bulls, goats, then bring this to pass, I pray you. Let your arrows make the Danaans pay for my tears shed. He spoke thus in prayer, and Apollo heard him and strode down along the pinnacles of Olympus, angered in his heart, carrying across his shoulders the bow and its hooded quiver. And the shafts clashed on the shoulders of the great god, walking angrily. He came at night, comes down, knelt opposite the ships and let go an arrow. Terrible was the clash that rose from the bow of silver. First he went after the mules, and then the circling hounds, and then let go a tearing arrow against the men themselves, and he struck them down, and the corpse fires burned and did not stop burning 9 days. On the 10th day, Achilles called the people to assembly. Achilles of the swift feet said, son of Atreus, I believe now that straggling back homeward, we must make our way, if we can ever escape death, if fighting now will crush the Achaeans and the plague likewise. No, but first let's ask our holy man, some prophet, even interpreters of dreams, since a dream might tell the mind of Zeus. Who can tell us why Apollo is so angry? If for the sake of some vow, some hecatomb, he blames us, or the wrong fragrant smoke of lamb or a he-goat, somehow he is willing to beat aside the bane that now afflicts us. Calchas, the best of the bird interpreters, who knew all things, said, you have bidden me, Achilles, beloved of Zeus, to explain this anger of Apollo. But I ask you, make me a promise and swear to me that you will defend me. For a king, when he is angered with a man, is too strong. Achilles said, speak, interpreting whatever you know, and fear nothing, for I will protect you if you but interpret the god. And this blameless seer took courage, and he spoke. No, it is not for the sake of a vow or a hecatomb he blames us, but for the sake of his priest, whom Agamemnon has dishonored, and would not give him back his daughter, nor accept the ransom. Therefore the archer sent his griefs against us and will send them still, not sooner thrust back the shameful plague from the Danaans until we give back the glancing-eyed girl to her father, but without a price. Agamemnon is a word that means steady one, and you find throughout the poem that he is unshakable in his opinions. Plague and grief are words associated with Apollo, and Achilles, it is assumed, is derived from words that mean grief of the people. So he is, in a way, the speaker for the grief that has come upon the Danaan people. Just as we had in Egypt, we have in Greece the power of the names of the lineage. And so I'm going to read to you now the lineage of Agamemnon, and then I'm going to read a scene from a battle later on that talks about two friends who meet on the battlefield and talk about the uselessness of having a lineage if you're just like leaves in the fall. So this is the powerful Agamemnon. He's angry, and he's standing with his scepter. He holds up the scepter Hephaestus has wrought him. Hephaestus gave it to Zeus the king, the son of Cronus. Zeus, in turn, gave it to the courier Argephantes, and Lord Hermes gave it to Pelops, driver of horses. Pelops again gave it to Atreus, the shepherd of the people. Atreus, dying, left it to Thyestes, the shepherd, Thyestes of the rich flocks, and Thyestes, in turn, left it to Agamemnon to carry and to be lord of many islands and over all Argos. And before I do that, I'm going to name the warriors, and then we'll go back to the lineage. The other thing the Greeks want to know, and this comes up to this day, if you meet a stranger on a, particularly in the countryside, the greeting is, who are you? Who are your father? Who is your father? And where are you going? And we're going to hear that formula in the repetition of the lineage. But first, we are hearing Priam, the king of Troy, asking Helen, who is the captured queen who had been married to Menelaus, the brother of Agamemnon, to come sit by him and tell him who all these guys are. And the reason for that is that you don't really want to kill a nameless person. You always ask before you head into battle with someone who they are. This becomes an important issue when Patroclus takes on the armor of Achilles, and Hector thinks that he's fighting Achilles, but in fact he is what we call the Therapon, which is the substitute. That's what Therapon has to do with. So think of Freud having being the substitute. I mean, this is the meaning of his word for transference. The Therapon is the stand-in for the parents. But in this play, Patroclus is the stand-in, the Therapon, for Achilles. So think about that. So Helen, we find her in her chamber, and she's weaving that great web, a red folding robe, and working it into the numerous struggles of Trojans, breakers of horses, and the bronze-armored Achaeans, struggles that they endured for her sake at the hands of the war god. Iris of the swift feet says, "Come, dear girl, behold the marvelous things being done by Trojans, breaker of horses, and bronze-armored Achaeans, who have just now carried sorrowful war against each other in the plain. And all their desire was for deadly fighting, but now they're seated in silence, and the fighting has ended. Menelaus, the warlike, and Alexandrus are going to fight with long spears against each other for your possession. And you shall be called the beloved wife of the man who wins you." So Helen goes, and there's this marvelous, when she arrives, the old men chipper among themselves, sounding like cicadas, and they wish that she would go home. They love her beauty, but they wish she would go home. So we don't have the poet saying how gorgeous she is. We only hear the old men chippering like cicadas. She sits down, and Priam says, "Come over here, dear child, sit down. Look at your husband of past time, your friends, all your people. They're not blaming you. To me, the gods are blameworthy in this, that they drove upon me this sorrowful war against the Achaeans. But you could tell me the names of these people who are so tremendous. So who is this Achaean man of power and stature, though in truth others are taller by a head than he? Who is this lord who has the bright eyes? Such a man might well be royal." Helen, the shining of among women, said, "That is Atreus' son Agamemnon, widely powerful, at the same time a good king and a strong spear fighter. Once my kinsman, slut that I am, did this ever really happen?" And then he says, "So that's son of Atreus, and who is that?" And she says, he says, looking at Odysseus, "Tell me, who is that? What man can he be? Shorter in truth by a head than Agamemnon, but broader, it would seem, in the chest and across the shoulders." The truth about Odysseus is he had very short legs, but at council table, he was of equal height to all the other kings. But he was bandy-legged, and they play on that in the Odyssey. So I'm giving you these details because this is the way of individuation in Greece. We know every living detail about all of their bodies and their secret little vices and all of that. His armor is piled up on the prospering earth. Still he ranges like some ram through the marshaled ranks of the fighters. Truly, to be some deep-fleeced ram, I would liken him who makes his way through the great mass of the shining sheep flocks. Remember when Odysseus flees from the Cyclops by hiding under the belly of the... So this poet is already alluding to the Odyssey all through this. It's an ingenious kind of piece of work. Helen says, "Well, that is resourceful Odysseus, who grew up in the country, rough though it be, of Ithaca, to know every manner of shiftiness and crafty counsels." In his turn, Antenor of the good council answered her, "Surely this word you have spoken can be no falsehood. Once in the days before, now brilliant Odysseus came here with warlike Menelaus, and their embassy was for your sake. To both these I gave my hall kind entertainment, and I learned the natural way of both and their close counsels. Now when they were set up before the Trojans, stood up Menelaus, bigger by broad shoulders, but Odysseus was more lordly when both were seated." Third, looking at Aias, the old man said, "Who is that over other Achaeans of power and stature, towering above the Argives by head and broad shoulders?" Helen said, "That is the gigantic Ajax, wall of the Achaeans, and beyond him is Idomeneus, like a god standing among the Cretans and the lords of Crete, and they're all gathered about him. And all of those I know well by sight, and I can tell you their names, but nowhere do I see the two marshals of the people, Castor, breaker of horses, strong boxer, Polydeucus, my own brothers, born with me of a single mother." And what she didn't know is that they were already lying dead upon the beach. So here we have Agamemnon and his lineage, and we have the Trojans wanting to know who the Greeks were. And I'm going to skip now to two guests, two friends who meet on the battlefield, one from Greece and one from Troy. Glaucus, sprung of Hippolochus and the son of Tydeus, and the son of Tydeus come together in the space between the two armies, battle-bent. Now, as these advancing came to one place and encountered, first to speak was Diomedes of the great war cry, "Who among the mortal men are you, good friend, since never before have I seen you fighting? Yet unhappy are those whose sons march warfare against me. But if you are one of the immortals, come on down from the bright sky and know that I won't fight against the King of Heaven." So he's joking, and he's also saying, "Who among the immortal gods are you?" And the other one says, "Light-hearted son of Tydeus, why ask of my generation? As is the generation of leaves, so is that of humanity. The wind scatters the leaves on the ground, but the living timber burgeons with the leaves again in the season of spring returning. So one generation of men will grow from another. Yet if you wish to learn all this and be certain of my genealogy, there are plenty of men who know it. There is a city, Ephyre, in the corner of horse-pasturing Argos. There lived Sisyphus, that sharpest of men. Sisyphus, Iolaus' son, and he had a son named Glaucus, and Glaucus in turn sired Bellerophontes, the blameless, and Bellerophontes the gods granted beauty and desirable manhood. But Proteus, in anger, devised evil against him and drove him out of his own domain. Since he was far greater, from the Argive country, Zeus had broken to the sway of his scepter. Beautiful Antea, the wife of Proteus, was stricken with passion, and she went to him. But Bellerophontes, whose will was virtuous, turned her down. So she goes back to Proteus, the king, and utters her falsehood. Would you be killed, O Proteus, then murder Bellerophontes, who tried to lie with me in love, though I was unwilling. So there goes on 2 pages of what he calls his genealogy, which are all these little gossipy stories about who went to bed with whom and how they was born. This is the Iliad. And he comes down to the end and he says, this is my generation and the blood I claim to come from. He spoke, and Diomedes of the great war cry was gladdened. He drove his spear deep into the prospering earth, and in winning words of friendliness, he spoke to the shepherd of the people. See now, you're my guest friend from far in the time of our fathers. Brilliant Oeneus was once host to Bellerophontes. Now we're talking about at the very beginning of the 2-page diatribe on his lineage. So we're really going back to Bellerophontes the Beautiful, who turned down probably the 6 times great-grandmother of this fellow. And he's saying, he left a little golden double-handled drinking cup, a thing I left behind in my house when I came on this very journey. Tydeus, though, I cannot remember since I was little when he left me. That time the people of the Achaeans perished in Thebes. Therefore, I'm your friend and host in the heart of Argos, and you're mine in Lycia, where I come to your, when I come to your country. So let us avoid each other's spears. Let us not even become close in fighting. There are plenty of Trojans and famed companions in battle for me to kill, whom the gods send me. I don't have anything to do with you. So they exchange armor and they shake hands in the middle of this battle because they have old kinship guest ties. This is very important because each is now betraying their fealty to their king. They're refusing to fight, essentially. We then find a commoner who challenges Agamemnon, who voices the conflict. Why fight for goods and quarrels over a woman? Let's go home. Thersites. This was the ugliest man who came beneath Ilion. He was bandy-legged and went lame on one foot, with shoulders stooped and drawn together over his chest, and above this his skull went up to a point with the wool grown sparsely around it. Beyond all others, Achilles hated him and Odysseus. These two he was forever abusing. But now at brilliant Agamemnon, he clashed the shrill voice of his abuse. The Achaeans were furiously angry with him, their minds resentful. But he, crying the words aloud, scolded Agamemnon. Son of Atreus, what thing further do you want or find fault with now? Your shelters are filled with bronze. There are plenty of the choicest women for you in your chamber, whom we Achaeans give to you first of all whenever we capture some stronghold. Or is it still more gold that you want, that some son of the Trojans, breakers of horses, brings out as ransom from Ilion? One that I or some other Achaean captures and bring in. Is it a young woman? Do you want another woman to keep her to yourself apart? My good fools, poor abuses, your women, not men of Achaea. Let's go home. Let's get into our ships and leave this man here by himself in Troy to mull his prizes of honor, that he may find out whether or not we others are helping him. He has now dishonored Achilles, a man much better than he is. He has taken his prize by force, and he keeps her, Briseis, a woman that Achilles was in love with. But there is no gall in Achilles' heart, and he is forgiving, not. Otherwise, the son of Atreus, would have his last outrage. But Agamemnon and Odysseus make short work of this commoner, and Odysseus grabs the great scepter of Agamemnon, and he dashes the scepter against the back of Thersites, and he doubles him over, and he falls to the ground, a great tear dropped from him, and a bloody welt stood up between his shoulders under the golden scepter's stroke. He sat down, frightened in pain, and looking helplessly, wiping his tears. But we then find the conflict in Troy. And conflict is about home and hearth and what is a hero, and this is reflected by Hector. Andromache is talking to Hector, and she's pleading with him not to go back out to the battle. And she says, "Hector, thus you are father to me and my honored mother, and you are my brother, and you are my husband. Please take pity upon me and stay here on the rampart, that you may not leave your child an orphan and your wife a widow, but draw your people up by the fig tree, there where the city is open to attack." And tall Hector of the shining helm said, "All these things are on my mind also, lady, yet I would feel deep shame before the Trojans and the Trojan women with trailing garments if, like a coward, I were to shrink aside from fighting. And the spirit will not let me, since I have learned to be valiant and to fight always among the foremost ranks of the Trojans, winning for my own self great glory. And my mind knows it, and my heart knows it, that there will come a day when sacred Ilion shall perish, and Priam, and the people of Priam, and of the strong ash spear. But it's not so much the pain of Priam and the city of Trojans that troubles me. It is not the thought of my brothers, who in their numbers and valor shall drop in the dust. It is that you, taking away, it is that the Achaeans will lead you away, taking your day of liberty, and you will cry. And in Argos, you will work at the loom of another man and carry water from the spring, unwilling, but strong will be the necessity upon you. This is the wife of Hector, people will say, as you shed your tears, who was ever the bravest fighter of the Trojans, breaker of horses, in the days when they fought about Ilion. So I speak of you, so will one speak of you, and for you it will be a fresh grief each day to be widowed of such a man." So speaking, Hector held out his arms to his baby, who shrank from his fair-girdled nurse's bosom, screaming, frightened at the aspect of his own father, terrified as he saw the bronze helm and the crest of horsehair, nodding dreadfully as he thought from the peak of the helmet. Then his beloved father laughed, and his mother, and they laughed, and at once glorious Hector lifted the baby up into the air, kissed him and tossed him about, and said, "Zeus, and you other immortals, grant this boy, who is my son, that he may be as I am, preeminent among Trojans, great in strength, and rule over Ilium, and someday say of him, he is better than the father. As he comes in from the fighting, let him kill his enemies, bring home the bloody spoils, and delight the heart of his mother." And he set the child down into the arms of his beloved wife, and he said, "Poor Andromache, why does your heart sorrow? No man is going to hurl me to Hades unless it is fated. For, as for fate, I think that no man yet has escaped it, once it has taken its first form, neither brave man nor coward. Therefore, go back to your home, take up your work, the loom and the distaff. See to it that your handmaidens ply their work also. See that the men must see to fighting." And he kisses his wife. She goes homeward, and he goes back into the war. You get this incredible domestic image in the middle of these horrible fights. I mean, the other thing you have to know about, this is not Rome where the people are fighting all at once. These are knights. They go out on the field two by two. They do skirmishes. They have horses. Then they take a break. They gather the dead. They burn their dead. They mourn. So this is why the Trojan War lasted 20 years. I mean, it was basically a very long war. You want me to... Okay, let me... I have just a little more. All right. We hear the conflict. We now are going to Achilles, who is basically saying, I'm not going to fight. You can't make me fight. I'm mad. And, of course, that begins the tragedy of the Trojan War. And he basically says, I want to go home. I want to marry a woman, a bride of my own fancy. I want to enjoy her possessions won by the aged Peleus. I want to know the worth of my life and that all these possessions are just fable. And he tells us what his mother had told him, that he had had two sorts of destiny. One was that he had a choice to be an ordinary man and live a long and comfortable life, or he could be a young hero and have a glorious death. And he is telling us here that he wants to go home, and he wants not to risk that a man's life cannot come back again once it has escaped the barrier of the teeth. So you think of the soul as coming out. I'm going to, because of time, skip the long part where Hector and Patroclus meet on the field. But I had picked it because it tells us in great detail all the things that they inflict upon one another. It also gives us one of the darker images of Apollo. You have to remember that we started the poem by saying what god started the conflict, and it was Apollo. Achilles is part of the play because he realizes that as long as he is out of the battle, that the Greeks are not going to win. Patroclus, his squire and friend, says, let me go into the battle, I'll at least scare them, and I'll wear your armor, and I'll drive your horses. And Achilles says, fine, but don't go near the wall. In the battle heat, of course, Patroclus, which means glory to the father, gets heated up, and he drives near the wall, and Hector comes out and meets him. And they have a go-around over the body of the brother of Hector, who becomes inflamed, and now the two of them are going to duel. But the really dark image of Apollo has to do with Apollo first removing the chin strap on the helmet and then cutting the armor of Achilles off of the body of Patroclus, leaving him naked in the battlefield. And then probably one of the more, you could say, dishonorable deaths in the field is that Dardanian stabs him in the back. And at that point, Hector catches up with him, and Patroclus basically has to fight Hector, who is inflamed over the death of his brother. And in his dying breath, Patroclus says, now is the time for big words, Hector. Yours is the victory. But it was given by Cronus's son, Zeus, Apollo. And you have subdued me easily because they stripped me of the arms from my shoulder. So first Zeus and then Apollo, you're my third slayer, you're no one. So he takes away that edge from Hector in the battlefield. He then predicts that your day is coming, your death is near. They try to retrieve the body of Patroclus, knowing that if they don't, Achilles will go mad. And yet... and so they form a barrier around the body, and they try to get him into the chariot, and they try to get Achilles' horses to carry the body back to the ships. And this is one of the sadder moments of the Iliad, because the horses weep. The horses of Achilles stand apart from the battle and wept, as they had done since they heard how their charioteer had fallen in the dust at the hands of murderous Hector. In truth, Automedon, the powerful son of Diores, hit them over and over with the stroke of the flying lash and talked to them, sometimes entreating them, threatening that they were unwilling to go back to the wide passage of Hela and the ships or to get back into the fighting. They stood as a grave monument, which is set over, and they were staring as if into fire, and the heart inside them were filled with sorrow, and the tears dropped down to the dirt. And it's in Greek, it doesn't sound quite the same in English, but in Greek it's all in onomatopoeia, so you hear the sound of the tears dropping on the... It's a very sad... When they finally get back to the ship, Achilles says, "Xanthus, Balius, Bay and Dapple, famed sons of Podarge, you've come and brought your charioteer back." And the horse, Xanthus, stands, and Zeus makes him speak. And he says, "We shall still keep you safe for a time, O Achilles, and yet the day of your death is near. But it is not we who are to blame, but it is a great God and a powerful destiny. For it is not because we were slow, but because we were careless, that the Trojans took the armor from the shoulders of Patroclus. It was that high god, the child of Apollo, who killed him. But your day is coming." We get a lot of darkness in Achilles, and he attaches Hector's body to the chariot, and he drives him around the wall, abusing the body, which it is too much even for the gods, and they send his mother to beg him to stop this madness. But it isn't even his mother who can break into his craziness and his anger. It is Priam himself who comes in the dark of night and begs for his son. And he says, stirring in the other a passion of grieving for his own father, and he took the old man's hand and he pushed gently, and he said, "Achilles, take pity on me and remember your father. I am still more pitiful. I have gone through what no mortal man on earth has gone through. I put my lips to the hands of the man who killed my son." Achilles now wept for his own father and again for Patroclus, and the sound of their two mourning moved in the house. Then when great Achilles had taken full satisfaction in sorrow and the passion, for it had gone from his mind and body completely, thereafter he rose from his chair, took the old man by the hand, set him on his feet, and in pity for the gray head and gray beard, he spoke to him in winged words. And they make up, and they have supper. He gives him the body, and he becomes human again. He regains his heart. The last scenes really are... The Iliad ends suddenly. It ends with the funeral of Hector. And basically, the eulogies are given...